Welcome back to another episode of the CSK8 podcast. My name is Jared O'Leary. Each week of this podcast is either an interview with a guest or multiple guests or a solo episode where I unpack some scholarship in relation to computer science education. In this week's episode, I'm interviewing Ben Owens, and we discuss Ben's transition from working as an engineer to working in K-12 education, open source as a metaphor for teaching and learning, various stakeholder reactions to open source resources and learning, bridging the gap between out-of-school and in-school learning, iterating on teaching and learning, and so much more. As always, you can find links to some of the things that we mentioned, like other podcasts and books, by visiting the show notes at jaredoleary.com or by clicking the link in the app that you're listening to this on. You'll notice that this podcast is powered by BootUp, which is the nonprofit that I work for. If you haven't been to their website, bootuppd.org, you can find a bunch of free computer science education resources that I've created and learn more about our professional development. But with all that being said, we will now begin with an introduction by Ben.
Hi, everybody. My name is Ben Owens. I am the co-founder of an education nonprofit called Open Way Learning. And I've had a torturous path into the education arena, you might say. I actually started my professional career as an engineer and did the multi-global engineering firm thing, traveling all over the U.S. in locations from California to the Midwest and the Gulf Coast and all sorts of places in between. And then, like most engineers do, actually not, but I decided to become a public school teacher and landed in rural Appalachia, where I taught physics and math at an innovative high school, wall-to-wall project-based learning school. Did that for 11 years before starting my nonprofit. So delighted to be here today and look forward to the conversation with Jared.
I'm really curious about like catalysts that lead to like career shifts or just like changes, like big shifts in life. So going from engineer to educator, can you tell me the story behind that?
Yeah, it's interesting. Even when I was, you know, doing the corporate thing in engineering, and I worked for the multinational firm DuPont, if you're familiar with them, there were many opportunities for me to move from one location to the next. So where I could have just stayed at a single location, probably for my entire career, I always wanted to look for something different and see what I could apply my skill set into a different context. So that environment sort of seeded this conscious thought of me always wanting to do something different. And obviously moving from an engineering career to an education career was a pretty big move, much to my wife's chagrin, because it did involve a bit of a pay cut, as you might imagine.
Yeah.
And she, in fact, called it my volunteer work benefits. I guess for me, I grew up the son of educators. My dad was a college professor. My mom worked in the central office at the local school that I spent my K-12 experience with. And so I just sort of had education in my blood and denied that for the longest time. And then finally decided through my experience working in all of these different locations where I was either directly or indirectly responsible for hiring talent at these various locations. And that was operators, mechanics, technicians, even engineers. And what I noticed was we consistently had problems finding the talent we needed. And this was happening again in the Gulf Coast. It was happening in the Midwest. It was happening in California. It was happening in Charleston, West Virginia. And it just told me there's something fundamentally wrong if we, as one of the highest paid organizations, plant sites or research labs in these various locations, can't find the talent we need, and even having to go overseas to find the talent we needed. That just told me there's something fundamentally wrong with how we are doing this public education thing. And sort of the intersection of my background of, again, denying that that's probably what I really wanted and needed to do in life, and then that experience led me to say, all right, time to go to grad school, you know, learn a little bit about this education thing. And at the time, I was just sort of like, all right, this will be something at some point in the future, maybe when I retire.
Yeah.
But then this sort of perfect storm of my wife and I looking for land to retire. And then this school that I mentioned before, this really innovative school in Western North Carolina, which was part of, at the time, what was called the North Carolina New Schools Projects. And it was an early college. So the school was actually on a community college campus. So students would come and they would take college classes, right? You know, as a freshman in high school and leave with an associate's degree as well as a high school diploma, often 2 weeks before they got their high school diploma, they would get their associate's degree, which is the coolest thing in the world. Even if they didn't get their associate's degree, they would get, you know, on average of 60 plus hours of college credit. So
nice.
Theoretically, those kids could go into a university setting then, or whatever other thing they wanted to do, with 2 years of college paid for by the state of North Carolina, which was really phenomenal. Anyway, that's a long way of answering your question. It was just too good of an opportunity to pass up. And it just seemed like this was something well aligned with my idea of wanting to do something differently than just be a standard math and science teacher.
So there's a concept in teacher education known as apprenticeship of observation. And I forget if it's Lordy who talks about it or Bouge, but it's basically the idea that most people go through a K-12 tenure and they are apprenticed through observing teachers, and they kind of have this idea of what it means to be an educator. And so my idea of that, I thought, was very different from like when I actually then started teaching in the classroom. I was like, oh, this is what it's actually like. So I'm curious for you, like, having gone through school to become an engineer and like your K-12 tenure in college and whatnot, like, what did you believe about education when you were an engineer? And then when you actually got in the classroom, like, did you no longer believe?
What I believed about education going through engineering school, for example, was, you know, this process of going through, you know, a pretty rigorous engineering program. I brag on my alma mater, Georgia Tech. It's pretty well known as a good engineering school. But I will say that with the exception of a couple classes, I mean, yes, I needed to know advanced differential equations. I needed to do design classes and mechanical engineering and all these other things. But I see that it was more of punching my ticket. What I really needed, both in the K-12 experience as well as in my engineering school experience, and I did have some classes like this, particularly my lab classes or one of my thermodynamics classes, which was really hands-on, was the ability to simply solve problems. I mean, I'm talking about real-world problems, not a five-page derivation of some equation. But although, you know, there is some merit to that, I won't diminish that ability. But what was really important, what I found, and especially once I got into the working world, is when I was able to find colleagues who really knew how to get together and let's collaborate and let's solve this problem. Let's look at all the different angles. Let's go through a formal design process. I did not learn that until essentially doing, even though it wasn't called an apprenticeship, I was basically an understudy with a lot of senior engineers who knew how to do that really well. And that to me was sort of my epiphany moment of these are the things I really need to know. And then the cool thing was in that process, we inevitably brought in what one is in the design community would currently call our user, you know, so we would talk to customers. We would talk to the mechanics on the front lines. We would talk to the operators that were there at 3 a.m. running the process and really try to understand their perspective and then bring that in. And again, none of that, unless I was totally asleep that day, none of that was really taught in engineering school or really certainly not my K-12 experience. Those types of things, I think, when combined with, you know, the things that one needs to know as an engineer, or one could make the same argument that one needs to know as a lawyer or as a paralegal or a physician. I think it's those sort of transcendent skills that really need to be brought to the fore a bit more in our traditional education systems, K-12 as well as higher ed.
So how did you learn how to teach? And then how has that understanding evolved over time?
Well, fortunately, when I went to grad school, I was living, still practicing as an engineer with DuPont at the time in Charleston, West Virginia. So I went to Marshall University, had a graduate program there in Charleston, West Virginia. So their focus was on a constructivist approach. So Dewey, Paget, Vygotsky, I ate that stuff up because that really aligned well with my experience that I had had moving from a very traditional engineering school approach into a practitioner where I fully realized that, you know, learning by doing, getting in with the mechanics and rebuilding a pump or a compressor, that was infinitely more valuable to me than any calculus course I ever took. So that whole idea of constructing one's learning by simply experiencing it was really the game changer for me. And that was before I had any inkling that I was going to be an educator. But once I got into the teaching world, I had that strong value. And the school that I taught at, you know, we intentionally targeted students who first-generation college goers, minorities, low socioeconomic, and just other kids that just the traditional system, the traditional high schools weren't working out for them. And that made up, you know, like 98% of our student body. So we were dealing with kids who, you know, were traditionally the furthest from opportunity by and large, although there were some students that, you know, this is the path I'm going because I get the 2 years of college pay. But those types of students, our challenge was how do we rekindle that joy and wonder of learning? And my perspective, and one that I think we eventually got that was consistent with the ethos of the school itself, was get them experiencing the learning, get them into a position where they can do interdisciplinary work that looks like what the real world looks like. And when they do that, they see that, wow, I can make a difference in my community today. And I don't have to just plan for making a difference later. I can do it right now. And that was pretty cool to see.
The way that you just described that really resonates with me and is how I prefer to learn, how I prefer to teach, et cetera. But I'm curious, how have people reacted to the approach that you're describing for teaching and learning?
Well, for many of the students, they loved it. Again, because they had been told either directly or indirectly that you're a failure, that you don't belong here, you know, because you're not doing it my way, that you somehow must not care about your learning. And therefore, we're going to just do whatever is needed to sort of, you know, get you the minimum essential you need so that you can go on and do your thing. And again, that's not a indictment on any one single school or teacher or whatever. I think that's just the general system of, you know, you either get it with the approach, you know, you're either on board with my approach or you're not. And if you're not, tough. I've covered the material. And what we tried to do was simply say, all right, if you're not getting it, it's not your fault. It's my fault. And I've got to work at that. So I think when students saw that they really had agency, that we listened to them, that we really cared about what difference they wanted to make in the world. And we did the heavy lifting to try to figure out how we could ensure that what we were responsible for teaching, because my school was still a district school in the state of North Carolina. I was a public school teacher. I had an obligation of teaching to the standards that whether I agreed with them or not. So yeah. I took that very seriously. But rather than simply say, okay, today we're going to do this, I would look for how can I engage a student who really loves music in a way that we can connect these science and math standards to what they care about. Now, other educators were a bit skeptical. In some cases, fortunately, my principal was all on board with this approach and sort of let me do my thing. And just make sure you're meeting your obligations and that, you know, whatever you're doing, it is going to result in at least the ability that the accountability metrics that we have are going to look positive. And then, of course, the good news was that they did. Not just me, but my colleagues and I consistently had the types of test scores and all the other graduation rates, all that other, that would be the envy of any school. But there were some parents, particularly, that saw this as just a dereliction of teaching, because in reality, I was not teaching like what some students had become used to, which was come in and sit down and you're going to listen to me blather on for 45 minutes about some topic and take notes. And then you're going to do some problems and there'll be a quiz and whatever, rinse, repeat.
Yep.
And I wasn't doing that. And in fact, I refused to do that. Actually, the students, they could come to me and say, hey, Mr. O, we really don't get this concept. Would you please relent and give us a lecture on it? I'm like, all right, fine. So there was actually a group of parents at one time who developed a petition to get me fired. This was my second year of teaching. At that point, I decided, well, gee, is this teaching gig really something I want to do? And if I'm going to have to deal with this level of backlash, you know, because it was really hard on me as I was like really questioning, like, am I doing the right thing? Is what they are accusing me of really true, that I am, you know, not paying attention to what I should be and leading these students astray? Fortunately, at the time when that petition landed on my district superintendent's desk, he basically said, no way, this guy is actually doing what we want him to do. And I didn't have a whole lot of data at that time because it was still relatively early in my career, but he trusted me. My principal trusted me. My colleagues trusted me. And the good news is, with some exceptions, many of those same parents came back later and said, thank you for persevering with that, because I can see the result in my students that I don't think could have been matched with the traditional approach. The things that they are doing now, the things that they did in college, is just, you obviously knew something that we did. And so that was, coming full circle, was probably the best accolade that I could have gotten of any award that I eventually got. And they became our biggest cheerleaders for the school and for our approach, because it wasn't just me. I just happened to be an easy target because I was so blatant about it, where some of my colleagues would do a little bit better job of hiding below the radar.
Yeah, again, this is the apprenticeship of observation. People think they know how to teach because they've observed it. In any subject area I taught, I'd have parents come back and be like, well, that's not how I did it when I was in school. And it's like, you're right. And we have a better understanding of how we learn. Like, it's been 20, 30 years since you were in school. Well, I mean, our understanding, like, and research on this has changed a bit.
Yeah, thankfully, yeah.
Yeah.
No, for sure. I think what that experience did do, as painful as it was it really reinforced this idea of, for me to think about continuous improvement and innovation, I also needed to be very pragmatic about it. I needed to think, all right, am I going too far too fast? Like I had done in my engineering career, and I probably needed to do a better job of it as a teacher and listen to the parents, listen to the students, not only with, all right, what are you interested in, but how can I help make this shift? Because, you know, if you're coming into my class as a sophomore in high school, you've spent, you know, essentially 10 years in one modality. And now I'm doing a fruit basket turnover. And that's going to be new and strange to you. And I need to ensure that I'm providing you the scaffolding and the other support so that you can be successful.
Yeah, your mention of like the continuous improvement and innovation, that definitely resonates with me. Every year I'm teaching, it's different than the previous year. And like, I'd have former students come back and be like, why are you teaching it this way? Like, why didn't you do that when I was in the school? Well, because I'm continuing to learn and grow, et cetera.
Absolutely.
I really find a lot of value in learning from different sources and trying to apply them in unique contexts and whatnot. In our prior discussions before we started recording, like, it's clear that you have been heavily influenced by open source and have applied that into teaching and learning. I'm curious if you could expand upon that.
So I know for this audience is a little bit different than most. And hopefully there's some educators also that are listening to this that aren't just steeped in computer science and STEM and whatnot. But for those who aren't, you know, the open source idea is that a coder can sit down and create something and put it out there in an open source environment. And then that gets remixed and reused. And so there's a saying in the open source community that the best code floats to the top. And that's through this idea of crowdsourced iteration, that we're constantly looking at what can I do to tweak this and adapt it and remix it for my situation or for the situation as a whole. I don't remember the specific research, but it's one of the things that generally points to how, if a bug appears in an open source type of code, the time it takes for it to get resolved is much quicker than a proprietary, because you've basically got the entire planet of coders who have the ability to troubleshoot that. So that ideal really started resonating with me as I got into the education space. You know, again, from my experience of just knowing that collaboration and empathy with one's user, whether that, again, is the mechanic, the operator, the customer, whomever, that just casting that wide net for input on what am I doing? What can I do to make this better? How can I solve this problem? Really sort of was in my bones. And finding in the education space that we really didn't talk to one another was troubling to me. That going to a, you know, to a conference and sitting down at the table and introducing myself to an educator and saying, hey, let's share email and, you know, I'll be willing to give you, I remember this was in the days of the flash drive. I was doing this at a conference in DC. I met a fellow physics teacher. I said, here, I'm going to give you this flash drive that has got everything that I've ever done. At that time, it was like my fifth or sixth year. Every project I've developed, every activity, everything that I've developed, and it's yours. Here, take it. Just remix it, make it better. And he looked at me like I was insane. Like, what?
Yep.
Why would you do that? you know, that's worth gold. Like, why would you give that away? And my response was, why wouldn't I? I'm not in this, you know, to compete with you. I'm in this to ensure that whatever we're doing in this collaborative environment, we're helping kids make these connections that they need to make so they can be successful. And what I'm offering is one simple way to do that. And if you can take it and make those ideas better, all the better. So that whole ethos, as I started learning more about the open source principles of transparency and community and collaboration, inclusivity, adaptability, just really resonated at a level. And I think for me, it helped sort of solidify this ideal, this ethos that I was embracing, because I really couldn't put a label on it before. And then when I started reading about, you know, the open source community and that approach, I'm like, that's it. That's it. My co-founder for Open Way Learning, we sort of stumbled on this about at the same time. And in fact, he was working directly with a coder and just had a conversation. And I think that's, he brought that conversation to me. And I'm like, that's it. Eureka. That's what we've been after. That helps define this really radical approach that we're using. Yep. That really shouldn't be that radical. I mean, if there's any place that things like community and collaboration and inclusivity should be happening, it's in the education space. And one of the potential silver linings of the pandemic is I think it forced teachers and other educators to do more collaboration because they were in an environment where the rule book just got totally thrown away. And if you want to reach students in an environment that's totally different than what you've done in the past, you're going to have to reach out and listen to what others are saying. Listen to your user, listen to your colleagues, look at what things are working, and then remix them for your own context. And I think that was where we were seeing evidence of an open source approach. That's my 10 minutes or whatever I spent talking about how the whole ideal of open source. And that, by the way, is in Open Way Learning, that word open is intentional because we believe the open way is those characteristics, you know, that I mentioned before.
That resonates in a lot of different ways. So like the kanji that is around my neck and that is on tattooed on my side, it means the way, do in Japanese, and like open source, like for last 20 or so years on my website, I've shared any resource that I use when teaching or create, I just share it freely, all the presentations I've done, etc. So like this really resonates with me, but I have heard some pushback from some educators who have said, but isn't this just free labor? And so they're putting their efforts into something and then they're not getting like a return on investment for it. So I'm curious like how you respond to people who say that.
If it is simply a one way where I'm only sharing and I'm not receiving, that could be a valid argument. But I will submit that anytime I share something, whether it's the rule of karma or it's a tangible, that person reaches back out to me and say, hey, Ben, I loved what you did here. Here's how I remix. That to me is gold because I can take what they have done and it gives me that whole different perspective of how they applied this lesson, this resource, this protocol, whatever it was, in their own context with their students. That is that rapid prototyping mindset of let's take things and let's just constantly make them better. And then just in general, whenever you do that, you build a level of trust among colleagues that you're able to form this network that you can tap into. I used to play in the Twitter world a lot more than I do today. And I found that as a teacher, that was one of my best resources to sort of embrace this open source idea. Because I could go on and just say, here's a resource that I've got and just send it out to my community of followers and say, y'all try this out and tell me what you think about it. And, you know, within 24 hours, I would have 10 to 20 comments that were, you know, real time that I respected of educators literally around the world.
Yep.
Who were looking at something and giving me feedback. I can't put a currency on that. That is just huge. That helped me improve as an educator. It helped me that day and helped me just going forward to be more attentive to listening to their different perspectives. And you repeat that process again and again and again. When you do this level of collaboration, it always you find is more beneficial to you than anything that you can share out. So yeah, I get it. I spent countless hours pulling stuff together, but to me, that's an easy investment for the type of collaboration network that I was able to experience and benefit.
Yeah, one of the recurring conversations that I have with John Stapleton, who has been on the podcast a couple of times, is talking about like having hyper local curriculum. So there's this tendency to like create curriculum at scale where it's like, hey, everyone across the nation is going to use this exact same lesson, but that like clearly is not going to connect with every community, every student, teacher, etc. So the thing that I love about like open source and like just that ethos is like, if you go to a program or even just like a function and you copy and paste that into yours, you have to modify it in order to fit your needs. And I wish more educators saw lessons in that way as well. Like, here's somebody else's lesson. Okay, cool. I'm going to change it so it actually works better for the students that I'm working with, as opposed to just taking it copy and paste and not making any kind of alteration.
Whenever I get the opportunity, I always remind teachers I'm working with, do you know about the OER Commons? Do you know about Creative Commons? Do you know about, because legitimately we should not be copying and sharing copyrighted material. That's just, you know, that's not cool. Now, I would argue that, you know, in the education space, with some exceptions, we shouldn't have a whole lot of copyrighted material. And if you're in it for proprietary reasons to make money with your textbook or whatever, then I see you as the evil empire. And sure, I'll get a lot of pushback with that. But I think it follows that mentality of one size fits all. Let's create a textbook that is, this section is equally applicable in Anaheim as it is in Terre Haute, Indiana. And that's just not the case. So I always, you know, refer people to OER Commons, where you can look at open source materials that have been vetted by their peers, and they can take and remix to their own context and then load it back up and continue that process. And that is infinitely more valuable than any textbook that's proprietary or any teacher pay teachers, and don't even get me started with that type of approach, where we just simply say, well, if it worked over there, it's got to work for me. So I'll just take it and I'll regurgitate it in my classroom. That's not really quality teaching. Now, there may be cases where you could adapt it pretty much with no changes, but anything that I would ever get, I would always remix it. And I would remix it not at just the classroom level, but at the individual student level. And that to me is the holy grail. When we're really customizing the scaffolding, the activities that we're doing with each individual student. And that to me is the highest quality of teaching. That's hard, hard work.
Yeah.
But it is an investment that is worth the payoff. Because when you can finally see that glimpse of, oh, I get it now, because of the work that you've done at that personalized, individualized level, that's worth all the time that you invest to do it.
Now, you mentioned it kind of in passing, but I'm curious, can you explain what is Open Way Learning?
Yeah, so Open Way Learning, it's an education nonprofit that sort of, our theory of change is that you can't just focus on the latest buzzword innovation. Right. And which we see all too often in education, like, oh, STEM is the thing right now, so let's all learn to that. Or project-based learning is the thing right now. Or personalized learning or SEL, whatever it is. And that's not to criticize any of those programs. But unfortunately, they get treated like programs because we get used to this idea of seeing the latest thing, you know, oh, this is the sexy thing coming down the pipe. We've all got to do that.
Yep.
What we don't do typically as schools or districts, because it's hard work, is to step back and say, well, what are the cultural elements that need to be in place for these innovations to really be implemented with the level of fidelity that will meet the intent, like STEM or PBL or whatever it is. I mean, that's great when it's implemented at that level, but when it's seen as a program of the month, you know, we as educators will simply say, well, this too shall pass. So I'll do the minimum I got to do to keep my head, you know, below the radar. And once it goes away, then I'll do the same thing with the next big thing. In the meantime, I'm just going to continue teaching in a very traditional way. So when we step back and say, well, let's start with understanding our why as an organization, as a school, as a district, as a learning community, and do that in a way that produces what we call a living mission and vision. That is not just words hanging on a conference room or hanging next to the entryway, but it actually lives. You could shadow a student. You could say, hey, take our mission statement and walk around with a student today and tell us whether or not what you're seeing is consistent and in alignment with what we put on this document, this aspirational document. They should be aligned. So that's our first sort of criteria. The second is this idea of collective autonomy. If you've read Daniel Pink, you know his thing about human motivation, purpose, mastery, and autonomy. And this goes back to that idea of just because you've got a title as principal or assistant principal or superintendent or department head doesn't mean you're necessarily a leader. It means that you have the capacity to be a leader. But we need to widen that net to say our students can be leaders, our parents can be leaders, our community members, a first-year teacher can be a leader, and be flexible in that definition, and then give people the collective autonomy to bring that leadership to bear. Third is a culture of collaboration. So we work on how do we ensure that schools don't have just dysfunctional PLCs, but that actually have true professional learning communities where we are spending time learning from our colleagues. Because that's one of the premises behind that, is the expertise you need to be excellent as a school, as a department, as a district, already exists in that learning community. The key is how do you collaborate to bring those ideas forth? And then that leads to the fourth idea, which is when you have a collaborative community, a true learning community, to borrow from Peter Senge's definition, then you catalyze that with the open source sharing of ideas, of resources, of knowledge with one another. So sort of those four cultural elements that really get into the people and really get into the systems of living mission and vision, collective leadership, culture of collaboration, and open source sharing. Now you've got the stuff in the water to take something like project-based learning to a whole nother level, something like personalized learning to a whole nother level, because all of those cultural ingredients are working together to manifest it in a really cool way. And you've also got the ingredients to say, you know, this sexy thing coming down the pike isn't in alignment with our mission and vision. So we're not going to invest the time to do it. And that's not just one person's decision. It's a collective decision, because everyone within the learning community sees that there is incongruence with that thing and what they are doing to make the education space as good as possible for kids. Now, there are obviously exceptions to that. If it's a regulatory thing or whatever, the gods on Mount Olympus say, thou shalt do this. Obviously, you don't have a whole lot of freedom, but even there's enough wiggle room that you can at least adapt it in a way that you can apply it so that it matches that culture. So that's a really long answer to what is this thing called open way learning. And it's just this idea, it's the theory of change that we've got to be focused on this longer term systemic level, cultural level stuff in order to be successful, which often is a tough sell, which is why we don't go to big trade shows. Because if I'm standing next to, I won't name them, but ed tech communities or whatever that have all the sexy buzzwords right there, nobody's going to pay us any attention. But fortunately, there are enough schools and districts out there that have said, you know, enough is enough. We've really got to step back and take a different approach at this, because what we have been doing by chasing the buzzword edufad is just not working for kids.
So when I stepped into Boot Up working at the nonprofit, it allowed me to work with districts in ways that I hadn't previously when I was in K-12 and even when I was teaching higher education and whatnot. I'm curious for you, like when you started working in the nonprofit space, how did that change or reinforce your understanding of like education or educators?
Well, I'll tell you, just because it took a while to get my nonprofit status, you know, and just the going through the process, there was a period of time, about a year, where I was simply an LLC. And I was struck by the difference between the types of conversation I could have with folks when I was a for-profit LLC, as opposed to a nonprofit that could truly put out there and say, I'm doing this work for a higher reason than just making a profit. So I think just inevitably, I would venture to say that's probably going to be true for any social space or environmental or wherever. It allows you to have a level of credibility that I think my friends in the for-profit space can sometimes struggle with. Now, there are some legitimately good for-profit organizations in the education space. But we early on said, for us to really embrace this open source ideal, we've got to manifest that in every aspect of what we do. We've got to be able to pass the red face test when we have a conversation with any educator, that we're going to be doing this to co-design with your in-house experts what you need in order to be successful. We're not going to come in with a paint-by-numbers approach, although it will probably save us a lot of time if we just develop, here's the 10-step process to change culture. Rinse, repeat. But it just doesn't work that way. Every school, every district, every teacher we work with is a remix, is a start with empathy and listen. And I think that, to come back to your question, the consistent feedback we get is, you know, this is refreshing. Everybody that we've ever worked with, by and large, has just come in and said, do these things. And, you know, given us a workbook and given us whatever and given us the training and say, now go off and do it. And what you guys are doing is say, let's start by listening to where you currently are and what your goals are and what your assets are. What is the talent you bring? And how can we collaborate? How can we essentially, in a theoretically a three-day workshop, create an atmosphere that looks very much like what I described before with the living mission and vision, the collective autonomy, et cetera. And they see that, wow, this is pretty powerful stuff. And it's something that we can actually do to make a difference. And I've had teachers approach me, you know, in tears to say, no one has really listened to me in the 25 years that I've been teaching until what you guys just did in the last 2 days. You put me in a space where I could express my ideas in a safe way. Not that my idea got implemented, but my idea got heard. And that was so powerful. Thank you. It reaffirmed why I became an educator. And to me, again, that's one of those like, wow. That is the best feedback I could ever get.
Yeah.
Because it really means what we are doing, which is, if you want to boil it down, and it's all open source anyway. So you could, anybody out there could take it and, you know, become a competitor, I suppose. But I would just think we would be helping raise all boats. But you could take what we're doing, which is just simply getting learning communities together and using things like the design process, using things like empathy mapping to sit down and listen to students, to listen to teachers, and then take those ideas and remix them in a way that works in your local context for you, not for the school over there, for you. And then what we do is we right up front say, how can we work ourselves out of a job as quickly as possible so that we build that local capacity, those systems, so that it's not dependent upon open way learning or any other, that you've got what it takes to be that learning community of constant innovation and continuous improvement is just now baked into your DNA.
Now, if we were to zoom out from your perspective, what do you feel is holding back either educators or the field? And then what's something that we can actually do about that?
That's the $10,000 question. My experience in the education space, which, you know, I came in very naive, you know, Ben, this former engineer is going to change the world, or at least change how to teach STEM or whatever. And then this cold face of reality sits in. So what I have learned to call it, and not surprising as a former physics teacher, is the institutionalized inertia of the status quo. That the systems we have developed over time, where we just simply put in autopilot and do school, are so baked into our culture. And that's why I argue that unless you address culture, you're going to simply reinforce and further manifest the dysfunctional culture that is not serving kids, especially our kids who've traditionally been furthest from opportunity. We've got to shake up the culture. We've got to focus on those things and do it in a way that really means we're doing hard work that looks different than what we've done in the past, and not just rely on the way that we've always done things as the only way that we can proceed. So I would submit that there's no single institution, whether that's a district or a department of education at the state level, at the regional level, national level, no higher ed organization or community, no nonprofit that will individually, as an institution, change this. I think it will only happen if we have a crowdsourced approach that recognizes the best idea from wherever that idea comes from. And we collectively take those ideas as a way to say there is a better way than what we've done in the past. Now, the trick is, how do you get those ideas to really come forward? And again, I would submit they already exist. It's just we've got to encumber them so that they rise to the top. And that means teacher is going to have to be vulnerable and listen to ideas from their students. That means a principal is going to have to be vulnerable and listen to and follow through with ideas from their teaching staff, from their support staff, a superintendent, a state superintendent, whomever. They're going to have to say, I may not have all the answers. And so I'm going to have to really rely on not just my collective staff here, but I'm going to have to rely on this crowdsource mindset and cast that net really wider and create the systems where I can constantly listen to and act on those ideas. And again, I would go back to, when did that actually happen? Well, we just had it happen recently in the pandemic, when we made this massive shift in a very short period of time. Districts no longer were the necessary North Star with all the answers to many of their teachers or schools or whomever. So people had to be creative and had to look beyond what they have traditionally looked at. So that to me was an example of a test case of the potential for really changing the paradigm. So the optimist in me says, well, let's just continue doing that more and let's emphasize where it's actually beginning to sink in and have an impact. The pessimist in me, unfortunately, sees too many districts just saying, okay, we're going back to the same old way that we did prior to the pandemic.
Yeah, it's difficult with the industrial model so heavily baked into what typically occurs in education, but the way that you've spoken throughout this conversation has really discussed the value of bridging the gap between in-school and out-of-school understandings, practices, problem solving, ways of knowing, etc. But I don't know, it's hard to kind of change the landscape when we have this factory model, the industrial model that is so pervasive, when what you're describing is more of a networked model and to be able to share across that. So do you have any recommendations for educators who like want to break beyond those approaches and get into more open ways of learning?
Well, one that just immediately comes to mind is my friend Grant Lichman, and he's done some writing on this, I know, in the past couple of years, specific to the things that he's been seeing at this networked level during and post, well, if we are in a post-pandemic, which I would argue we're really not yet. And he's the author of the book, Moving the Rock, which I would highly recommend. So that's one example of if you really want to dig in further and look at a level of expertise. Someone that you've had on this podcast before, Aria Chernick, and her work at Duke is another example of how we can, obviously, she being at the higher ed space, is able to see an even broader perspective of how we can bring in this open source idea into many different applications, including, in her case, she's working with the Durham Public Schools on specifically a CS type of approach in general, that then uses computer science and programming in an open source. So basically both ends of the spectrum there. In the book I wrote, Open Up Education, or co-wrote with Adam Hagler, my co-author, we point to a number of other examples, and that's not a pitch for the book. It's just, if you want resources, find somebody who's got a copy and read that as well. But that idea, as you alluded to, is still pretty radical. It is still pretty new. I mean, even to this day, when I speak to teachers who I know have been doing wonderful collaboration. And I just bring up, so tell me how you collaborate with your own district or maybe with your own region, because I see them collaborating on Twitter or on national networks or whatever. Well, I never even considered that.
Yeah.
And so I think it's indicative of when we get into this industrial model system, this paradigm is so strong, it just tends to cloud this idea of what we could be doing. And the idea is right there. The methodology is right there. It just, sometimes it just simply takes a shift where, like, well, why don't we collaborate? Why don't I go across the hall and just sit in a colleague's classroom? And then we just have a conversation later about what did I like? What did I wonder? Because when I was teaching, that was the best feedback I could get. Sure, the annual observation and the forum and all that, you know, that was beneficial to a certain extent. But the best feedback was a colleague who does the same thing, works with the same students, and is able to look and say, hey, Ben, did you know that what you're doing with these three students is just probably not very effective? Why don't you try this? Because that's working in my classroom like night and day. Oh, wow. I would have never even considered that. And thank you for that insight. So little things like that, I think that we can do within our own sphere of influence, but anything that you can do to collaborate, intentionally collaborate and share, be vulnerable with others, you're going to become a better educator doing, or you're going to become a better superintendent doing that. It's so powerful. We've got to get away from this idea that we may think that we have all the answers, or because of our own experience, or because of what we've done in the past. We've always got to say, what I'm doing today has got to be better and different than what I did yesterday.
And one of the things that I really appreciate that you have reiterated multiple times is like elevating student voice in this experience. I'm curious what you would recommend specifically for that, for educators who might immediately jump to, oh, I can collaborate with other educators. But like, how could they learn from and with students?
When Open Wave Learning does our work, we do have available if schools want to use it. We don't force it on anyone, but it's kind of like a maturity model of some of the foundational things that we've just seen that we know that work, that should be part of that systemic ecosystem that you have in place. And one of those is a vibrant advisory program, whether that's at the elementary, middle, or high school level, is, are you spending the time developing relationships with students? Are you spending the time addressing social emotional needs of students? Are you listening to what their goals are? What gets them up in the morning? What makes them tick? Now, sometimes that may be a hard conversation, because if students have not been in that environment, they may be reticent to share. But if you are persistent and just invest the time to get to know students, then they are going to develop that level of trust and respect, mutual respect. And you're going to also be a little bit vulnerable by asking them to tell me how I'm doing. Tell me what I could do that would make this class better. That, what could I do to make this lesson better, this project better? And you may get some pretty biting response. I certainly did. Like, Mr. O, never do that project again. It was awful. Okay. You're exactly right. I thought the same thing. You just helped validate that. So yeah, having an advisory program in whatever form it is, whatever way that you can do that. And if your school is not supportive, then figure out a way that you can bring that to your own individual classroom. I promise you that investing that time in developing that solid relationship is going to pay off tenfold as you go forward. So that is sort of the foundational level. And then it's simply asking. It's asking in a one-on-one level. It's saying, hey, I want to have a focus group. Anyone that has a birthday between June and October, I want to meet you over in this corner. Everybody else, just continue working on what you're doing. And you go and you simply have a conversation with those students. I've got this. This is what the idea I'm bouncing around. What do y'all think? How could I make it better? How could I make it where it has a more direct community impact? And then the other thing, we would do this from time to time, is actually take students to the Chamber of Commerce meeting. You know, just say, hey, who wants to go to the Chamber of Commerce? One was pretty striking, where we as teachers would go to the Chamber of Commerce meeting in our school. And sometimes we were the only educators there. But that was where I could have a direct conversation with the plant manager of the local Snap-on Tools plant, for example, or with a physician at the local hospital, or with a paralegal or whomever. And I could say, well, what are some of the problems that you're working on that our students could also work on? Because chances are you've got some issues that you simply don't have the time, money, and resources. And when students can engage in that conversation with someone that they respect in their community, or that they just didn't know about, it opens many, many doors that you can take advantage of. That's another helpful hint that I would encourage folks to do, is just whatever it takes to blur the lines between what's happening in the school and what's happening in.
Do you have any recommendations for how to prevent burnout that can come with like that iteration? Like, those are some excellent examples of like how you can like kind of practice and iterate on your own abilities by getting feedback from students. But it's difficult being an educator, as you mentioned in the story about like being petitioned. Like, how did you and do you work through stresses like that?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there are folks that are listening to this saying, yeah, that's great there, Ben. You're probably smoking something, because there's no way that I could do that, anything close to what you're talking about. And I won't kid anyone listening that this is indeed hard work. What I found was, by doing that hard but different work that was more collaborative, more inviting, more inclusive, was so much more rewarding that it was worth it. It was worth the time investment. And if I had worked half the number of hours that I did, but was just sort of going through the motions and knowing that it wasn't having the impact, that would have burned me out within a heart. Because what was motivational, and this goes back again to, I think, what Daniel Peek talks about, is that purpose, mastery, and autonomy. I knew that at my school, there was a clear living mission that provided purpose that was consistent and in alignment with what I wanted to do to make a difference in the world for the time that I'm on this planet. That was my way to channel that and affect it with the students I was working with. I had the ability to master things by knowing that I could collaborate with colleagues, knowing that we could share ideas so that we could constantly get better and continue to become better teachers and master that approach. And then I had the autonomy. That didn't mean that I could just close my door and do my own thing. I had the collective autonomy where, again, our ideas mattered. What I could bring as a passionate educator to my colleagues, and they could listen and they could give me feedback, was respected. So I could leave at the end of the day knowing that with that purpose, mastery, and autonomy, I'm doing good work that is in alignment to my core values as a person. And I think that ultimately is, if you are in that place, which I was fortunate enough to be, and I would also say I'm pretty fortunate enough to be, since I run my own nonprofit, I guess I'm my own boss. So I just make sure that ethos exists in this community as well, that you can leave with a smile on your face and knowing that you've done good work that day. Now, I think as you're alluding to, you can also take that to the extreme and become just insane. And my wife would probably argue that I do that on occasion. It is imperative that you block time. And I've gotten good at practices like just, I'm going to block a day and that's my day. And it's not the weekend. It's my day where I still may be doing work, but it's work that I get to dictate. I get to define. I get to sit down and read or just do something that's totally different and is not dictated by a meeting or whatever. And then, you know, I'm also shut down at 4 o'clock every day. I'm done unless there's a specific thing that others expect me to be in for whatever reason, but I'm pretty stingy about what those can be. That's the time where my wife and I and our dog and cats can enjoy being together. We can go walk in the woods, or I can go on a run, or I can do whatever. So I think it's having that level of discipline to know that, you know, when you're doing work, you're going to go all in, but you're also going to ensure that you protect time as well so that you're honoring self. And don't treat that as being selfish, but treat that as part of the entire system to stay healthy in all the different ways that are necessary.
Yeah, I really appreciate that response. The work that I do literally will never end in terms of like the series of things that I can always work on. So like having those firm, here's when I start working, here's when I stop working, that definitely helps. Now I say that with full recognition of I started at 5 a.m. this morning because I woke up at 4 and like, it's just like one of those days where, all right, it's definitely going to be like a 10-hour day. But in general, I try and do 8 to 4, get my 8 hours. And
we all have those days, but... Yeah, I think as long as we do it in moderation, then we're honoring self. So.
I'm curious, what do you wish there's more research on that could inform your own practices?
I know that there needs to be more research on just the approach of using an interdisciplinary approach to education. Like, what if we just simply de-siloed the process and got kids working on experiences, whether it's project-based learning, problem-based, place-based, profession-based, whatever XBL you want to say. I know there's some, like University of Michigan collaborating with Michigan State, just published something that you can find on the Lucas Foundation about the impact of things like project-based learning, experiential learning. It shouldn't be just, that's the one example that we can point to that shows the impact. Because anecdotally, every situation, whether it's in my own school or the schools that I have the privilege of working with, when teachers embrace that approach and move away from the industrial model, it's a total game changer. And especially for students who the light bulb has gone off and they're just like, all right, I'm going to bide my time until either I can drop out or until I graduate and just, you know, let me just kind of keep my head down. When you're able to impact those kids where they are shining in a way that nobody expected, themselves, their parents included, that's beautiful. And I know there's a research piece of that that can validate it in a way that we can point to traditional metrics or whatever. And so I think we need more of that. And let's see, other areas, the reality of the fourth industrial revolution with AI and just so many things that are just racing by us, there has to be something. And if it is research that points to the fact that the current model is not working to sufficiently prepare our students for that reality, and if the research is the thing that motivates folks to actually make that move, to make CS more inclusive, to make STEM more inclusive, to help ensure that, yeah, just because I'm an English teacher, I'm not going to worry about coding, to something where I'm going to worry about whatever it takes, regardless of my diploma I have on my wall over here, I'm going to do whatever it takes to equip these kids with what they need to be successful. And I'm going to collaborate with my colleagues. Now, I may bring a little bit of expertise in this area, but the big picture is how are we preparing our kids to be the entrepreneurs, the change makers, the difference makers, and not just the test takers.
Yeah, I like that. What's something that you're working on that you could actually use more help with? Like from a listener or something?
Oh my gosh. Where do I begin? I think any listener who has heard something that I have said that can just point to either, well, what you said was BS because I have over time developed a worldview, but I'm sure it's very biased. And I'm sure it is not representative of, especially as a white male, you know, I inherently bring a certain bias to this, that I constantly am looking for and always know that I can do a better job of listening to others, particularly our communities that have historically been oppressed by folks like me. And I think that's one thing first and foremost. And then others are just, is there something out there that says, well, you know, Ben, the work that you're doing could be catalyzed if you considered this, or if you looked in this arena, or here's an example that you could highlight that is actually making that difference. Because I think if we can look at those pockets of equity, look at those images of what's possible and elevate those and have folks then act on it, like, all right, how can I replicate that? Because that community looks really similar to the community I'm working with. How did they do it so I can do it? And again, take that idea of if we share and remix and localize it, then I think we can get better. So anything like that would help me as sort of the, if I'm doing nothing else, then saying, hey, you District A, you need to collaborate with District B and this other nonprofit because what they're doing is amazing. And I never see a penny of that other than the fact that I got them together. That's all good because that is beginning to make that shift happen from this industrial model to something that's more equitable and purposeful for kids.
I love how so many of your answers just embody the open source like way of being. Like it's phenomenal. I don't know how intentional it was in that response, but it's just like spot on.
Very good. It'll probably be on my epitaph that this was the open source guy who struggled with coding in Python.
Do you have questions for myself or for the field?
I guess the big question I always have is how radical is what I'm proposing from your context, as you've had the experience in the higher ed community, you've had the experience teaching, you know what the system and the resistance potentially. So am I really out there in the tundra screaming to nobody's listening? Or do you think you see any elephant in the room that can be impacted by this, by some element of what I'm discussing?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And this might sound like a non-answer, but I've seen enough districts to realize that there's a huge continuum of what would be accepted and what would not. So like one district that I was in where I got put on a growth plan because I like created a lesson based off of the previous four lessons that they gave us. And they came in on that one and they're like, this isn't a district approved lesson plan, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay, like you didn't give me five lessons for 5 weeks. So I made one up based off of the previous 4 weeks. Like, and you love the lesson. So districts like that would probably hear what you're talking about and go, nope. But then like other districts that I've been in and other districts that I've seen, like their end goal is to just get kids interested in learning and to be able to do something with what they learn in school outside of school. And in those districts, yeah, they'll listen to this and be like, yes, this totally resonates. Let's do this. I'm on board with it. The hard part is like trying to figure out with that first district, well, what is it that you value and how can we get at that through this approach that also really works probably even better for kids than what you are mandating and whatnot. So like, had I had the understandings that I have now, if I were to go back to that first district that I taught in to be able to engage in those conversations with the administrators and just sit down and be like, what do you hope students will learn? And then what are some different approaches that we can use? And how might we align this approach that I highly recommend with what you're trying to do? And I think bridging those conversations would help. But yeah, I totally think everything you're talking about could totally be done in education. It's just a matter of getting like administrators or even like you mentioned earlier, like parents on board with understanding like, hey, this is a valid way of, you know, learning and teaching or facilitating, et cetera.
Great. I appreciate that feedback. And I think the way that affects the work I do is we intentionally don't try to evangelize to that first district and examples like that. I mean, because there are enough folks out there that are pointing to, we've got to do something differently.
Yeah.
And certainly with what we just experienced in the pandemic, where the curtain got pulled back and we got to see the sort of the ugly underbelly of this industrial model that has just been existing for too long that needs desperate change. So I can say, and this again falls in the theory of change, that if you get a coalition, schools, districts, educators in general, who are willing, then that's where things like the collaboration and the sharing and the trust can affect the type of change we're after. So that's my guarded optimism based on what you're saying there. And I'm excited to continue to work with those folks because, again, not that I've got the answers, but I think we've got a way that we can help their answers come to the top, including listening to students along the way and letting them co-design with us something that's going to work better.
So where might people go to connect with you and the organizations that you work with?
So my email is ben@openwaylearning.org. So feel free to shoot me an email, whether you agree or disagree with anything I've said today or indifferent about it. And openwaylearning.org, you can just go to that URL and you will see our website. You can also find me on Twitter @EngineerTeacher and @OpenWayLearning for our nonprofit. And we're also on LinkedIn and Facebook, same thing. So if you just do Open Way Learning, you'll eventually find us if it's not one of the first things that pop up. That's my contact info. And I'm always happy to hear from others and collaborate. What can we do to develop that coalition of willing partners? As you probably can tell by now, I'm pretty passionate about not just doing it myself, but having willing collaborators to co-design that with me. So we raise all boats.
And with that, that concludes this week's episode of the CSK8 podcast. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. And I hope you consider sharing this with somebody else or sharing a review on whatever app that you're listening to this on. This helps more people find it. Stay tuned next week for another episode. And until then, I hope you're all staying safe and are having a wonderful week.